Today is July 23rd, 2014, and this is episode number 264 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, Managing Editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, Time Lord. Get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast. You can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
I'll show you my sonic screwdriver if you show me yours.
Different demographic.
Yeah, that's, we definitely have some crossover, I'm sure.
Yeah, we do. So this is, we are absolutely proving that timey-wimey is wibbly-wobbly.
It is, and full of stuff.
And full of stuff, because we've actually already recorded the show.
We have, so we know what's going to happen next.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's awesome. And actually, it is really good. This is one where I got to just really enjoy the discussion.
That's good. That's good. So what we're about to do is we're going to bring in Dave Hamilton.
We are? I had no idea. Oh my gosh, it's so exciting.
That's so exciting. Dave Hamilton is the president, TMO, my business partner here. And we started a discussion. I guess we kind of talked about this a little bit in the stuff we've already recorded. But we were going to bring him on for just a segment. And because his time was limited today, we were going to record his segment separately. And it ended up being a long conversation.
Now, to be fair, we did record his segment separately.
Yes, we did.
So yes, there's we did. That.
There is that. And but it ended up being the whole show. And we're continuing a topic that we raised last week on TMO's Daily Observations, the podcast that Jeff hosts on a daily basis.
And you didn't feel like you had been able to adequately represent your feelings, and so we gave it another shot.
Well, I thought that it's a topic I'm very interested in.
I had no idea.
And the short form, I know, and the short format of TDO essentially left me.
You needed more than a quickie. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I was tilting my cojones off.
Different demographic.
And Dave was kind enough to rejoin the conversation and go through it in a lot more depth, and it's super interesting. I think we go in some interesting directions and talk about some interesting things, and there you have it. That's going to be what the show's about.
Well, I'm gonna sit back and break out the popcorn and see what happens.
That's probably
I can't wait to see how this comes out.
That is probably a good idea.
Yeah.
So without further ado, let's make for an awkward edit and start up the pre-recorded stuff.
Awesome.
So we have a guest today. And so we're actually recording this before we record the rest of the show. So if the flow isn't working, just bear with us here.
Now, our time is not linear.
Exactly.
And now neither is yours.
And that, time is an abstract concept. It's bizarre, right? I mean, we rely on it, and yet there are things that can actually change the way time proceeds.
It's true, but on a measurable level that doesn't really apply to us.
It definitely applies to me.
You don't think it applies. Yeah, I think it applies to us far more than we realize.
Yeah, I know for me, when I watch the two of you duke it out over some topic, time goes a lot faster on my side.
See?
See?
And time goes faster for me when we duke it out. And so, what does that mean? I think if the measurement device is not in the same phase as the people experiencing it, you know, then the measurement device is going to show that time ticked at the rate that you expected it to tick, because the measurement device can't be, the phase of the measurement device can't be changed. However, our phase can be changed, and therefore time ticks at a different rate.
Are you talking about perceived time? Or are you talking about the physical aspects of both the one's rate of travel and proximity to large gravitational masses?
I'm talking about perception being reality.
Interesting.
I'm Dave Hamilton, by the way.
Yeah, this is Dave Hamilton that's with us.
And I was going to get there. This day in physics.
I know. That's right.
Phil Platt has nothing to worry about.
No, all is safe over there. No matter what time he thinks it is.
Exactly. All right.
I'll let him know.
Speaking of time, last Thursday. Was that Thursday? I think it was Thursday.
Might have been for you.
Well played, sir. Well played. Last Thursday, give or take a bit, depending on the observer, the Mac Observer's daily observations, we talked about publishing and about, and it was Kindle Unlimited that sparked this. And Dave and I got into a bit of a back and forth where, I'll be honest, Dave pretty much trounced me in the argument, in part because, first of all, he argues well, but secondly, because I allowed myself to go on super mega mad monkey tilt and didn't do a good job of discussing it. And I also thought it was an interesting enough topic that it just really deserved a little more time than we have with TDO.
So what you're saying is that this time that we're talking about it is about you?
Yeah.
All right, sweet.
Well, it's all
checking.
Yeah, Jeff knows.
Yeah, and the way I see it, you guys entertained me so much on TDO last week that I'm totally fine for a rematch. As a matter of fact, I sent the interns out to make me some popcorn right now.
We have interns?
Oh, yeah.
I got to stick around.
Sierra, they're not the best interns.
Sierra and Ainsley.
Ainsley.
There are a couple
of them. Wait, what are their names again? I think you got that wrong.
No. I got it. You're the one who always gets it wrong. It's Sierra and Ainsley. And yes, Ainsley has two E's in it, Dave. They're both males.
Oh, so Ainsley is perceived to be female?
No.
Okay.
They're two guys. They're two millennials. Their parents wanted to give them unique names.
Sierra is a guy?
Oh, yeah.
Now, that's a first for me to hear that name used for a male. That doesn't mean that it hasn't been. It's a first for me. Timing. Well,
you know how millennials are. They're just breaking down boundaries everywhere.
So what I'm curious about Ainsley's parents, if they appreciate the stellar work of another awesome timekeeper, Ainsley Dunbar.
That is a good question. My guess is that they are largely ignorant of Ainsley Dunbar.
That is a dang shame.
Yeah. Fun fact.
All I know is that both of our interns say their parents don't understand them.
It's totally true.
They gave him crazy names.
So, totally true. Dave, when I was in a band in the 80s, we had a bit called Dunbar.
Ah.
Little cadence thing, just FYI.
Yeah.
All right, so here's the deal. Amazon introduced a little thing called Kindle Unlimited, which is, we actually know a little bit more about that than we did at that time.
Should be called Kindle Limited.
It is fairly limited, but it's a subscription plan that allows you an effective all you can read buffet for books. So you can have up to 10 at a time. Once you have already downloaded 10 books, when you finish one, you can download another, and it's $10 a month. And it is mostly limited to books published through Kindle's publishing arm and Kindle Select self-published books. So to be part of it, you actually have to be part of the Select program, which means if you're a self-published author, which means that your books are only available through the Kindle platform.
So I have a couple of questions, both for me and perhaps to enlighten our listeners here. You can have 10 books at a time, but is there any limit that they impose, like X number of books maximum per month? Or if I can read a book a day, well, they just give me a book a day and 30 a month.
Okay. So I'm only making an educated guess on this.
Okay.
I don't think there's a limit.
Okay.
Based on what I've read, it doesn't look like there's a limit other than up to 10 checked out at any given time.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's cool. So my other question is, give me an example. Give all of us an example of what this means. That what types of books we can find. I mean, are there books there that any of us would want to read? I think the answer is yes, but maybe not the newest release stuff. Is that?
Well, so in addition to there's going to be books that are published under Amazon's publishing arms that are absolutely going to be new books.
Okay.
By solid, well-respected, you know, and or successful authors. But that is definitely a minority of what's available, because the vast majority of the books that are there are all through the Kindle Select self-publishing program. And they also have a few books from other publishers. For instance, Scholastic.
Okay.
Scholastic has signed up for this. So you can find books like the Potter books and the Hunger Games, for instance.
Okay. So other publishers could, if they decided to sign on board, and presumably that would require some additional negotiation between the publisher and Amazon. And
correct.
All that good stuff.
Though, yeah. Amazon claims the right to be able to put any book they want, as long as they pay for the download. As long as they pay the publisher for the download.
Sure. So they would have to pay for, if I say went and got the latest Stephen King book or something.
Stephen King books aren't there.
Yeah, right. But if they decided to put that in there and I downloaded it, even though I only kept it for as long as I read it and then have to return it, as long as they paid Stephen King for a purchase of that book from me, we're good to go.
Yeah, I don't think you have to return it. This isn't lending. This isn't the lending library thing.
I know, but I can't keep it on my device.
Yeah, I think you can.
Well, I can, but then it becomes one of the 10, is what I'm saying.
Right.
Right.
Are you sure about that? Because I thought it was... Do you have to, like... I thought once you finished a book, you could download another one.
Right, because that one leaves your device.
I didn't think it left your device, but it could.
I'm pretty sure it leaves your device. This is sort of like Amazon trying to route around the libraries and take over digital book checkouts.
Right.
Well, they already do that with the Kindle lending program.
Sure. And this is just another piece in that, pretty much.
And so the way they're doing it is, if you, the reader, get through 10% of the book, that triggers a payment from Amazon to either the author or the publisher.
All right.
So the Lord of the Rings, for instance, is one of the books that they had on there. It's clearly a loss leader that they're putting on there with permission being irrespective.
Okay, so they're doing that exact thing with Lord of the Rings. They're just going to pay that out. For everybody that hits 10%, they pay as though they purchased it.
Correct.
Yeah, that's smart. I mean, that's good business right there.
Yeah. It is.
Hate this.
Well, no, what I hate is the effect of this.
Okay.
What I hate is that I think that that Kindle Unlimited is part of a very orchestrated campaign to not only suck all the profits out of publishing and retailing, but to also, as part of that, lower the perceived value of books.
Yeah, and this is what we talked about on TDO.
That's the part that we talked about.
Yeah, to offer my counter to that, I love tinfoil hats. I do. I emotionally support.
And they do look stylish on you.
I do. I have a collection. I emotionally support every conspiracy theory. So
correct.
So with that, I definitely emotionally support what you're going for here. But I think, but that's the limit of it. And I think it's an emotional reaction from you too. I don't think Amazon's being sinister here. I think what they're doing, and this is what we explained on TDO, is they're looking to where the publishing industry is going to inevitably be anyway, and getting there so that they're the first. because we've got streaming music, right? You know, that, and it's a similar thing. We don't sell as much music anymore. And the streaming music pays pennies on the dollar to the artists compared to what, and I say artists, what I mean is the machine. It pays pennies on the dollar to the machine, which is the publishers, you know, the labels and everybody that has their hands in the pie there. Pennies on the dollar from streaming as compared to previously what it was with sales. And it's just the way the music industry is. And now, you know, you have to have a deal that includes merchandise and touring and all that stuff for everybody to make money. But there's simply less money being made certainly from sales, perhaps more so from touring, because since the Rolling Stones Steel Wheels tour, we saw concert ticket prices change dramatically, right? It used to be the same price for every seat in the venue. This is true up until 1989, not that long ago, right?
Yep.
And then the dude, I can't think of his name, but he's genius. Bill Graham was going to promote the Stones on their Steel Wheels tour. And this dude showed up and he said, if you let me promote you, I'll do, and you do 30 dates, I'll get you $30 million. So $1 million a show. And the Stones were like, huh, okay. And they signed the contract with him. And that's when front row seats started costing more than back row seats from the venue. You know, the scalpers were always charging that much. The venues got involved. And other things happened too. He got, you know, sponsorships in, you know, that tour was sponsored by Budweiser. All of that changed. And now we see even venues leasing their branding rights, you know, to things, places like Comcast and all sorts, like the SBC Park or whatever the heck it's called now, right near you.
Sure.
You know, but that's a long way of getting to saying the music industry had to figure out where this money was going to, the entertainment industry, the live entertainment industry had to figure out, okay, where's the rest of this money going to come from? How are we going to make this up? And that was part of it. And I think the same thing is going to have to happen in an appropriate way for books. But as far as the content goes, I think this quote-unquote streaming model, which is effectively what we're talking about with Amazon here, you don't own the book, you just have the rights as long as you're paying your money every month. As soon as you stop paying your money, none of those books are yours. Even The Lord of the Rings that Amazon paid as though you had purchased, you don't get it if you stop paying your fee for $10 a month.
That's probably how it's going to end up working out.
That's definitely how it works out, right? I mean, it's $10 a month. You have access to it, and then you don't have access to it if you stop paying. It's the streaming model for books. So my point is, I don't think Amazon is being sinister by implementing it. I think they're being shrewd and smart by trying to be the first ones, because as soon as Apple does this, you know, maybe Amazon doesn't quite have the pull that they need, and then that's the end of that. So that's where we were on TDO.
That's where we were on TDO, and I think that there's a lot more to this conversation, but part of that a lot more is that if taken in isolation, I'd be pretty willing to go with your spin. And, you know, if everything was in a vacuum or if everything was equal,
sure.
As it is, I think that there is the reality is there is at least some truth, if not all truth, in what you're saying. That Amazon is trying to go where the ball is going to be.
It's true what I am saying. It's true that I am saying it.
and what you're saying may also be true.
Well, that's a side benefit.
We have a long history of Amazon doing other things to use price as a cudgel to keep out competitors. And that's part of why I think that this is part of this long road to, you know, sucking the profits out of the industry, but also as part of that, lower the perceived value to keep competitors out.
Well, I mean, you have to remember, Amazon, in theory, makes money selling books, right?
So, well, yeah, sort of. They don't really make any money, but go ahead. Well,
right. But that's the thing, is if there were a model that would allow everyone involved to make more money, that would be in Amazon's best interests. because they make money selling books. So to say that their goal is to take the profits out of the book sales, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, I see why you're saying that, but this is part of my disconnect with Amazon, is that Amazon doesn't make any money.
No, they don't. Right, I know.
And so it's like they want to keep other people out of retailing, in books in particular, but in general, they're putting constant pricing pressure on every industry that they touch. And the fascinating thing is that doesn't turn into money for them, unlike, say, Walmart, another company that is famous for putting massive pricing pressure on everybody.
Yeah.
They have still structured their company in such a way that it makes the shareholders and the Walton family a ton of money.
Right, right.
But Amazon doesn't. Amazon does some of the same techniques in terms of pricing, but yet it doesn't make any money. And that I think that's one reason why I get so bent out of shape out of this, is because we saw in the PC industry in the 90s in particular, we saw the results of the race to the bottom, where as everybody's competing on price, innovation goes out the window. Quality became poorer and poorer and poorer in the PC side, until Apple turned around and with Steve Jobs changed those rules and started competing on everything but price.
Right.
And right.
I think you're not seeing where Amazon is going with this. And I have a hypothesis, which is that Amazon is willing to take it on the chin long enough to gain the control over the market that they want, at which point they're now in control of pricing across the board, and no one else can get in and compete with them. Right now it's books, but that's not the only market that they have their eye on. I think Amazon is playing a very long-term game here, and we're just seeing one component of that playing out right now with books, with dropping prices and a changing market in how we receive and then perceive those books too.
Well, and that's been the accepted institutional wisdom for Amazon, that there's going to come that day when they're going to take all these sales and all these credit cards, right? I think, Dave, you and I talked recently about how many credit cards Amazon has.
Right.
So, was that you and me?
Yeah, and you know, they're one of the few that has amassed this ability to charge people, you know, by the millions, right? And I mean, with people's permission, but you know, they're at the precipice of being able to launch a mobile payments thing, right? I mean,
that's what we were talking about.
Yeah, right. And so is Apple, and potentially so is Google, right? They don't have the credit card mass that Amazon and Apple does, but they sure, like you said, they sure have the customers. So
yeah, they have the user base.
Sorry, and thank you.
So yeah. The institutional wisdom has been that at some point Amazon's going to turn on the profit hose, and for a big part of the last year, I think that Amazon stock has actually risen in the last few weeks. But for a big part of the year, Amazon stock actually went down as Wall Street seemed to finally get tired of waiting for that profit machine to be to actually be turned on,
right?
But and the problem with the idea of controlling the market and then finally making a profit in books is that Amazon sort of has this nobody can win model, where the moment they started making a profit in books, it would allow another competitor to come in.
Yeah, see, I think Amazon is less ruthless and more visionary in terms of their what drives them every day. If they were ruthless, they would be making money at some point. They've been around long enough that it's time, right? But like you said, they haven't turned on the profit hose. They're constantly trying. They've always been, if you look at where Amazon came from, they came out and shook up the industry. I mean, they were the first big, and they still are one of the only, but, you know, or one of the biggest, rather, not certainly not one of the only, but they were the first big internet you know, storefront where you could go buy things. It started with books and, you know, and obviously moved on from there quite a bit. Now we all just buy everything there. But I mean, that was, you want to talk about something disruptive. Holy crap. And everything that they haven't always succeeded at being disruptive with everything. But everything they do, I think, comes from that point of we can shake it up. We can change it. And I honestly don't think they care as much about profits as they do about being disruptive. I really think that you know, the vision there is what's wrong with the world? What's wrong with the way the logistics of the world work, and what can we do to fix it? And books is the next thing that they've chosen to focus on, right? And that's again. It.
Yeah, it's, you know, coming back around, because that was obviously the first thing they were.
Yeah, right.
On.
Oh no, you're right. At first it was, we're going to ship you books, and that's better than going to the bookstore. And now it's, I mean, obviously the Kindle, disruptive, right? You know, and changed it. And now, kind of, and we might say that this step is more iterative, or it's certainly iterative of where Amazon has come from. How disruptive it is, we will see. But it has the potential to be both an iterative step, you know, on top of this framework that they've laid, and a very disruptive one at that, because this is one of the places that the book publishing industry can go, is to this streaming model where every other bit of entertainment is heading. Now, is that where it will actually end up? I don't know. Maybe, but maybe not. But I think authors have to wrap their heads around the fact that the old model is probably not the one that you want to set your sights on. You don't want to bank on that.
Well, okay. So a couple things. Let me step back just a tiny, tiny bit to Kindle itself. Kindle itself is a prime example of why I think Amazon's race to the bottom is bad for readers. And that's actually that, you know, that's my central, all of my angst about this, all of my worry, I don't know, 10% of it maybe is my status as an aspiring author, aspiring fiction author, that is. 90% of it is the fact that I'm an avid reader.
Yep.
And the Kindle platform, to me, language started off as something really interesting and disruptive, but then it didn't improve until Apple came along with the iPad. And even the first Kindle app for the iPad, when you compared it to the first iBooks app, it was a drastically inferior reading experience, in my opinion. And I tested them both. And Amazon stepped it up, and they kept releasing iterative improvements to that Kindle app until it became almost as good. I don't think it's as good, but it's almost as good as the iBooks app in terms of that reading experience. And that's because, in my opinion, Amazon was competing on price and they weren't competing on experience. And that's why Amazon agitated with the DOJ so much to get agency pricing halted at the federal level, because they knew that they couldn't compete on experience, and they weren't interested in competing on experience, and they wanted to keep the rules where they were king, which was to compete on price. And I think that is a prime example of why my angst is well founded. Because as an avid reader, I want a great reading experience.
So how does this all fit in with the traditional library model? Because that's been basically a streaming book service that goes back hundreds of years.
That's a great question, Jeff. Because you're right. We could get for years, if we were willing to wait in line behind our neighbors, we could basically get any book we wanted for free to read.
I wouldn't say any book, but a lot of books.
Most. Yeah. Well, for a long period of time, since the library was the largest list of books any of us knew about,
right.
It was any book that you knew about. Right. I mean, it defined itself. So yeah, it really was. You could get anything you wanted because you wouldn't want something you didn't know about for free, just for living in your town.
Well, so like one issue with libraries that a lot of readers would experience is they might be able to get the first book in a series. And this is especially true for genre fiction, like fantasy and science fiction, fantasy in particular.
Sure.
Or romance, historical novels, things like that. You get the first in the series, but you may not be able to get the second or the third in the series.
Yep.
And so you end up having to buy that one if you want to continue the series. So that was actually the source of my quibbling on any book you wanted.
Sure. Sure. But it was, you know, that you're right. It was free streaming of books.
Right.
Yeah. And that worked for a long time, and then it stopped because of technology, and it you know, that model didn't adapt the right way. It has tried to adapt. We still have.
Yeah, libraries are actually working hard to adapt to mm-hmm. modern realities, yeah. and to greater and lesser degrees of success.
Sure, of course.
And of course, one thing that a library that any online source, like say Amazon or even iBooks or whatever, anything like that, can't replace is the community center aspect of a library,
right?
And there's functions there that can't be duplicated online, and it's whether or not local communities are going to be willing to pay for that stuff, I think, that'll really, really establish the long-term viability of libraries.
Sure. Yeah, but I guess the point, and perhaps this is the one you want to come back around to here, Brian, that I don't get is, you seem to have great value as a reader, and perhaps also as an author, but certainly as a reader, you place great value in what the publishing industry does for us as the readers by creating this infrastructure. Is that fair to say? I want to let you expound on that, but right?
You are striking, yes, absolutely. So here's my take on this. Self-publishing is a fantastic thing. I think that the one of the things that I think Amazon deserves massive amounts of praise for is allowing people to self-publish. And in fact, I wish Apple would put even 20% of the effort that Amazon has done for the iBooks platform. I wish.
Have you not launched iBooks Author?
I have. That's that's part of my complaint. iBooks Author is fantastic for doing a lot of iBooks design.
Yep.
But I don't think it's well suited for your average writer taking their manuscript, which is either going to be in Word or something like Scrivener or something like that.
Sure.
Storymill, and then turning that into a book that can be published. It's nowhere near as easy as it is to do with Kindle.
Yeah, good for instructional books. iBooks Author is fantastic less for good for like fiction or something like that.
And that was Amazon. That was Apple's. You know, they made it clear that that they were designing that for like textbooks,
right?
And then people like you mentioned David Sparks.
I did
with his book. He just it's funny on Tuesday, he released a new book called Presentations.
I know. The Field Guide to Presentations. I've had it for a couple of days, so I've been reading it, and it's good, man. It's really good. Anybody that does... This guy, David, is an excellent presenter. I've seen him present many times. My guess is that in the process of writing this book, he has become an even better presenter because...
That's saying something.
The stuff that he talks about in this book... I feel like would make me 10 times better a presenter than David ever has been. And since he wrote the book, I kind of have to assume that he's read it too. So, you know,
likely.
So Amazon gets all this credit from me. Me, the bitchy, whiny boy. Right? Amazon gets a lot of credit for me for opening up, making self-publishing viable. And you've got authors like Hugh Howey and whoever wrote 50 Shades of Grey and a handful of other authors who have been extraordinarily successful with that. I would argue, though, let me come back to that. The thing that traditional publishing does, they act as gatekeepers. This is true. And sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad. There are a lot of really bad self-published books. But there are also a lot of, there are at least some really good self-publishing books. But the thing that the publishing industry has been doing for decades, not centuries, but decades, is training authors, teaching them how to, and this is sort of indirect. It's not that the self-publishing or that the publishing industry is set out to train people, but as a course of what they do, the infrastructure can teach authors more about writing books, how to tell a story. On this, on the nonfiction side, where I've worked with Bob Levitis on some Dummies books, I know a lot more about how to write a book after working with the folks at Wiley on those manuscripts, stuff that I you know, had no idea until I actually went through that process with them. On the fiction side, editors can spot the problems with your story. They can spot the problems with your plots, with your voice, when you all these mechanical aspects of telling a story that go way above and beyond copy edits.
Okay, so why I'm with you there. There are some authors, every author will benefit from that to a greater
or lesser degree.
Exactly. Right. And some don't need it at all, and some, by golly, if they don't have it, they're dead in the water. And what I hear you saying is, without that, we as readers are going to have crap to read. We won't have anything good left. Why?
Well, no, that as a whole, our reading experience is going to deteriorate.
Why and is that? I mean, are we readers just stupid sheep that will just take, we've seen the light, right? We've read good books. We've read edited books. We've read polished books. Will we simply lower the bar because, whatever, it's $10 a month. I just want to read to pass the time. I don't actually need to get a lot of enjoyment out of this.
No, I actually think it'll probably result in less reading eventually, on some measurable level. But the reality is that over the last 10 years, as margins have been squeezed in the traditional publishing world, and they have been squeezed, both from outside competition, right? That's actually one of the things I think that you've been effectively alluding to is this massive increase in competition for entertainment dollars.
Right.
That it's affected every existing industry.
Right.
Right. In games, music, movies, books, whatever.
Yeah.
I have personally noticed an increase in the number of copy mistakes that end up getting through published books as it is. And this is because, and this opinion is based on lots and lots of research, the reality that publishers have fewer resources to apply to any given book, but especially with new authors. What we're seeing right now happen in the traditional publishing world is that the superstars are able to continue to get anything and everything that they need. And new authors are not they're not as easily able to get publishing deals because, the reality is no one makes any money on anyone's first book.
Right.
Right. The author doesn't make any money. The publishers don't make any money. Retailers, no one's making any money on an author's first book except for, like, one in 100,000.
Yeah, right, right. Sure. The exception to the rule. Yeah. But
and
go ahead.
Well, we've already seen some of this happening, and I think it's going to accelerate. And I think as the perceived value of books decreases and as publishers make less and less money, we're not going to see the level of attention that new generations of authors need to become great writers. That is my worry.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, the publishing industry is a lot more and a lot more bloated than simply people helping coach new authors, authors in general, new and old alike, right? There is that aspect to it, but there's a lot more. There's the marketing side of it, right? The everything, the packaging, and packaging meaning, you know, digital packaging, but, you know, the PR side of this is huge. So to keep an entire industry around for one aspect of it doesn't make any sense. And also to say that if we get rid of an entire industry simply because there's less money and they're the middlemen and so they go away, right? I mean, that's is also crazy because in the record industry, right, we had this and still have at some level the same thing, right? You've got these big publishing houses and they have A&R reps and they have producers that they work with and they have engineers that they work with and all of this stuff. And you can do all of it at home, right? You don't even need to go to a good sounding room, although that helps, right?
It does help.
But you don't have to. But that's part of my point is you still can, and in many cases, it's a good idea to. And whether you do it at home or in a nice room, you can rent the room yourself or own the room if it's your home or, you know, lease it or whatever you do, however, whatever your arrangement is for your domicile. You could bring in an engineer that knows more about that, you know, setting mic placement and recording than you do. You could bring in a producer that knows more about getting a sound than you do. You can send your finished product to a mastering house that knows far more about the esoterics of that than any of us care to learn. But let me tell you, it makes a difference, right?
Huge.
You can use those people, but you don't have to. But there is a benefit for certain things. There is a benefit. There's also something to be said about the very raw thing of somebody recording a killer song with the single microphone on their iMac and putting it on YouTube and actually getting, you know, it's speaking to people that way. And I think that's actually a really good part about all the walls that have come down is, you know, somebody writes a great song and sings it with an acoustic guitar in front of their Mac and records themselves with the stupid camera in their Mac and the stupid microphone in there and puts it out there. And if the song is good, man, people will find it and people will share it and it will be a thing, right? And we've seen that and it's awesome. And then maybe it's time to take that song and record it in a slightly nicer room with a slightly nicer microphone. And maybe it's a more than just one track, you know, and be able to mix it. And that can happen. And, but, you know, and then you can add the producer in. But we have options now. And we as consumers are actually better off, I think, now with the music industry than we were back in, say, the 70s, when the 70s, 80s, even 90s, when the only thing we could listen to was the stuff that was created for us to listen to and very carefully engineered. And I don't mean engineered by where we're going to place the microphone, but the process of getting it from artist to our ears was
even the sound, the record industry for the vast majority of new artists in particular, the producer's job that was hired by the label was not to capture a sound. It was to create a sound.
To create a sound, right.
Or you know, twist the sound, you know, like make the band into something that they weren't.
That they weren't, sure. And so.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I
That's
think,
true. 20 years ago, we couldn't have had Jonathan Coulton or Pomplamoose.
Right, exactly. There was no way for those types of people to get their music to anyone more than, you know, a coffee shop size crowd without other people being in the middle and then therefore it being changed, right? And there are authors like that too. But as you said, there are authors that don't know how to write and need to be coached, and there is no one stopping them from hiring an editor. And frankly, I think this creates a market for killer editors, right? And they exist. They're at these publishing houses. So strike out on your own and say, hey, we're going to edit your book for you. And we're either going to do it for a cut of the take or a flat rate, right? And then it's on you to promote it. And maybe you want to hire this promoter that I know of that does well.
Dave, I can tell you, though, that at least so far, I realize that things could change. At least so far, that potential process does not produce the same results as trade publishing, for good or for ill.
It will.
That
it will.
It could. I don't see any reason to expect that it will. I think that the competitive pressures, competitive realities are going to make that part of the process a lot different. And then there's the fact that...
But here's the thing. If you're Jonathan Colton...
The creation process...
Right. If you're Jonathan Colton and you want someone... You want to bounce your song off of someone that you trust before you go and put it out there on YouTube or whatever, but by whatever channel he wants... He can do that, and he probably does. What in the world is stopping an author from doing the same thing? Nothing.
Because, oh man, it is so different. I've recorded music.
Yeah.
And I've written a book.
Right.
And the creative project, man, so for instance, a song. Listening to a song, writing a song, recording a song is such a shorter process.
In general,
there are always exceptions.
Right.
And there are,
but no, you're right. The lion's share, yeah, you can write a song in an hour. You can record a song in a day.
Even if you work on a song for a month.
Right.
You're not working on it 8 hours a day.
Right.
For a month.
Right.
If you take a month to record a song, you're not recording a single song for 8 hours a day.
No, of course not. That's right.
Not even the most anal retentive musician, you know,
yeah.
most obsessive musician can spend 8 hours a day, 6 hours a day for a month on a song. And you know, I've recorded an album, and of course, you've done at least as much recording as I have, probably more. I've recorded an album in a 3-day weekend.
Yeah, you can also take 6 months to record the same length album.
You can absolutely do that.
And of course, are normal.
Both are correct. Both are absolutely normal.
Yeah,
but the process of writing a book is so much longer. And then the process of even being able to critique a book, like, you know, I've had a lot of beta readers. This is definitely anecdotal evidence, but it's backed up by a crap ton of research with other writers. The process of getting a beta reader to tell you what they think of your book and to be able to get great feedback is, I would say, infinitely harder than getting someone to listen to your song.
Sure, because it takes more of a time commitment. But you're talking about...
It takes a different skill set, too.
Well, yes.
It's a much different skill set. I think a lot more people are equipped to listen to a song and to know whether or not they like it.
But you're talking about...
to read a manuscript.
You're talking about mixing art with convenience of the artist. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. If you want to write a book, you write a freaking book. You know, but, it doesn't, nothing's, you don't, well, it's going to take a long time, so I'm not going to write a book. I mean, of course, you know, then you're not an author, right?
I mean, no, it's, Dave, it's not that. It's that for the last, I don't know, 3 years now, I've had a 3/4 time job that doesn't pay anything.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm a little obsessive, and yes, I'm in a particular place in my life where I can dedicate that kind of time to something.
Yeah.
And I've chosen to do so. And quite frankly, the reason why it's taken so long is because I didn't know what I was doing when I started.
Sure, of course.
For absolutely and positively sure. And that's one of the reasons why I want help from the publishing industry.
Why couldn't someone offer a course for aspiring authors?
People do.
Bingo. So you don't need the public. What I'm saying is all of these things that you want can still exist without this behemoth of a publishing industry. They can be available a la carte. You get what you need and only what you need, and everybody else gets what they need. And you know, you're a testament to the fact that this can happen because you have not stopped, right? I mean, you've written this book. You yes, it takes more effort for people to read it, and yet you don't give up. You're a, you know, you crack the whip. You're like, oh, have you read my book? 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 You know, that, but that's good, right? Because you're passionate about it. And that's, I don't see why that passion can't drive a quality product in the end, even if you, the author who is passionate about it, are not, at the beginning of the process, equipped to deliver that quality product on your own.
Because I think that the barriers are so much higher for book. The difference between the book industry and the music industry are such that the learning curve cannot be navigated by most people on their own.
Now, as someone that
so that's an
that
opportunity
is not in the music industry. Did it used to be the same way there, where people felt that that those barriers were too big to get in?
They were too big. Well, you couldn't have a studio in your house.
Yeah, that was the thing, is you couldn't record in your house,
right?
Yeah, let alone the room. The stuff that Dave's talking about in the room, that stuff that
it's minutia compared to you can't record in your house, right?
Yep.
Yeah, you used to need to go and were somewhere where there was, you know, a 2-inch 16-track tape machine and a big mixing console. And that still exists, and there's a good reason to still use it, but you don't have to.
Don't have to.
Right. No. So, I hear all of this, and I go back to what I said during TDO. Boo-hoo for the authors. You know what? If this,
I'm not worried about the authors, man.
Here's the thing, though. I know you're worried about the readers, but if this weeds out the crappy authors, then what we're left with is the people that are passionate and know how to write and are going to be able to make this happen for themselves and get it out there. And that's the guy's book who I want to read.
Well, so how are you going to find that, man?
Dude, we're on the internet. How are people going to find this podcast?
Find a great, well-written, self-published fiction book right now. Go. Let me know how that works out.
I've got the world at my fingertips. I've got people that have read it. I find reviews. I'm good to go. One of these problems is an opportunity, right? Why does Mac Observer exist? Because there was no place for people to go and get that kind of information. We willed it into existence, right? You're talking about. Okay, well, there's no place to go and find books that people are publishing on their own. Sounds like an opportunity to me. I just don't get why
it's an opportunity. And that's fine. It is theoretically an opportunity, but it's an opportunity that no one, despite lots of money being poured into it, has been able to conquer so far. Maybe it'll be conquered someday.
Well, if you
but right now, if you go to Amazon, this wonderful bastion of self-publishing, which again, I like.
Yep,
you're going to have to wade through acres and acres of dreck to find the occasional gem. And I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to wade through acres and acres of dreck.
You mean like finding a good website to read?
Yeah, but finding a good website to read, but where the number of websites are even larger on any given topic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an issue. Listen, where I've researched and looked at this, the people I've talked to, discovery is a huge issue, and discovery in the self-publishing world is an even bigger issue.
And discovery
hasn't been conquered yet. It could be.
Discovery is an issue with music too. I mean, it's still driven by the radio.
It's true
in many ways, and that will not last forever. But you know,
agreed.
So discovery is always an issue. I mean, you want to talk about discovery problems? We're on a podcast. Oh, we're on a podcast. Yeah. Find a good podcast. I mean, how do you know what podcast you would like based on other stuff you like? Apple's, you know, their thing it's not that great.
No, it's not.
Discover, for instance, here's the trick.
People let us podcast.
Don't discover a good podcast, because that problem has yet to be solvable. Discover a good podcast discovery service. That is the task right there. All of this, discovery is the key, but it's not just an issue for books. It's an issue everywhere. And we solved it with websites. Google solved it. Yahoo and Lycos, and then Google sort of iterated on that concept. But you know, Lycos and AltaVista, they solved that problem.
Man, that's a throwback.
It's where we came from.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, Dave, I know that you're running out of time. I definitely appreciate you being willing to explore this topic in a lot more detail.
This is fun.
It's a very interesting topic to me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was awesome. And
I really appreciate you guys entertaining me so much for so long.
That's our job.
Yeah, and you're great at it. And I thought it was an awesome discussion too.
Thanks.
Sweet.
Thanks. You know, Dave, you can drop out if you want, but since we managed to take the entire show on this topic, why don't we just record the outro?
I'll let you guys record the outro while I run to the post office.
All right, Dave. Awesome. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and that's this week's Apple Context Machine. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your feedback. And I'm totally riffing the outro today because why not?
I scrolled over to the Skype and scrolled up.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I was reading what you put in there for last week.
Oh, well, and I was kind of close. But the point is, go over to the iTunes store and rate the show for us. And there. And now you say some stuff, Ryan.
We are doing the show right. Go to the iTunes store and you can follow me on Twitter. No, we won't do that one. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boone, recorded just for us. And that's all for this week.
Oh, and I know the next part. That's where I say, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.